name is José Andrade, and I come from Brazil, from the very nose of Brazil. It's a city called Fortaleza in the state of Ceará. It's a very dry place, but very nice. And I have some collaborators from there. The first three are from Fortaleza, and the first two are from this country called France, somewhere in Europe, Professor Marcel Filoche and Professor Bernard Sapola. So they are both from Ecole Polytechnique. And I have a small story just to say that how did I get into this this stuff. So it was Bernard, when I first met him in France, that talked to me about the screening problems. And I found that my background is in chemical engineering. I found it very interesting. And I thought someone would have to sell it to engineers. So since they are mostly, since I'm the most connected one to the engineers side, I was elected to do that. And we have been having a very hard time to do this. It's not so easy. So, but I will try to tell you what I tell to them when they try to sell the problem. So the first of all, everybody heard about the Laplacian systems here and the screening effect. And the typical picture that we want to show is, for instance, the transport of heat from a flat interface here to a rough interface, which in this case is a Koch curve, but made in a very regular way. So we apply Dirichlet boundary conditions at the flat interface, a constant temperature here, which is small in here, if you wish, and the heat will flow through diffusion, in terms of a Laplace, which can be described in terms of a Laplace equation from here to there. And you can see that you see different profiles of temperature along the system in the bulk. It's more interesting to see, instead of the temperature itself, to see the flux in the system. And as you can see, most of the flux are concentrated in those zones which are more exposed. So this is what we call the screening effect, because those regions which are deeper in the geometrical structure practically have no activity in the system. Okay, so we have been working a little bit on that. Some papers have been published. And of course, we come to the Makarov theorem, which was, unfortunately, he's not here today. I would say it's a very interesting achievement in the sense that he solved the problem for this particular type of boundary conditions and two-dimensional system, in the sense that if you have a diffusion cell with the boundary conditions at the interface, and you have a Laplace equation governing the transport phenomenon of your system, what do you have is, this was translated, I think it was, first of all, Bernard had contact with Professor Peter Jones, yeah, who gave him this mathematical expression here. Bernard tried to translate it to me, I couldn't understand it very well. So Bernard was very kind to give me this better explanation for the Makarov theorem, which says that the set where the activity takes place has a dimension equal to 1, which means that the length of the active zone is proportional to the system size. So this is a more physical explanation for me, which means that if you can measure the activity of the interface in terms of parameter LA, let's say, and we will find this LA is proportional to the system size, the given power alpha, and in fact this power is equal to 1, if, of course, we're measuring the information dimension, and so on. So from here to here, this is a typical mathematical to physicist pathway, and from physicist to an engineering pathway, what we do, we simply say that the prep factor is equal to 1 and apply it to our systems. So this is a dramatic thing for engineers, I would say. Why? Why is it dramatic? Because whatever you do with your interface, whatever distortion you cause in your interface, if you increase that, it doesn't mean that you increase the effectiveness of your system. So I'm sure that most of the people working in engineering, in the design of heat exchangers and catalysis, don't know that. So it's like when you have a terminal disease and you don't want to believe. But if a mathematician comes with a theorem and say, okay, you're going to die, it's more or less like that compared to the Makarov theorem, you know? Okay, so that's what the type of picture we try to show to people in order to understand. It's a very pictorial representation of the Makarov theorem, in the sense that I used to say this is a substrate of the black part is a substrate of a catalyst, on the top of which you put some gold, which is in fact a typical material used activate the interface. So if you put pardon. Not because of she.
She's very active.
But the point is exactly that. If it wasn't so cheap, Makarov wouldn't have so dramatic impact.
It's almost cheap for capital. It's much more expensive usually.
Of course, yes.
If gold is the low cost stuff.
No, I mean the manufacturing stuff is also very, very expensive.
Well, but the usual thing you want to use is platinum.
Platinum.
Oh, yes, put gold here, just to. Platinum wouldn't give a so good contrast. So but so the point is that you have some sort of substrate and a live interface between them, which is the gold itself. And what is active, of course, in a plane interface, in a flat interface, is 100% of that. Of course, when you, by going through a fractal type of iteration process, when you distort this zone, when you create some inclusion on this, what the Makarov's theorem says, in practical terms, is that if you keep the system, the size of the system invariant, the activity is the same, whatever geometry you might have in two dimensions, under Dirichlet boundary conditions and Laplace equation. So if you increase it more, you spend a lot of gold for nothing. That's the basic point. So in practical terms, you reduce all your diffusion problem to geometrical, to a geometrical screening efficiency, which is simply the ratio of the perimeter of your system and the system size. Okay. So, of course, we don't immediately believe in this theorem, and we go to Endicott. I'm being very honest with you. So we go there and we calculate it. So that's what we do for a square curve. We solve the diffusion equation using exactly the recipe of Makarov. And instead of calculating the information dimension here, I calculate something which is more related with the correlation dimension. So I define the activity of the interface in terms of the normalized flux at each elementary unit of the interface, normalized by the entire flux at the interface. So I square it, I sum, and I inverse it to have what we call active length of the system. So this is a very convenient way of defining the participation in this special geometry, in the sense that if all the fluxes are the same, if you hypothetically had equally distribution of fluxes along the interface, you would have equal partition of fluxes, and of course, your active zone would be equal to the perimeter of that.
Why did you put the square?
It's exactly to have these two properties. No?
Square and pi pi square.
But to have this, no? it's a measure of the dispersion. No? And if you have the entire flux concentrated in a single elementary unit of your interface, you would have what people in the condensed matter physics study, localization, would say it's a strongly localized system. So we found that the value for this calculation was 22.9 for this particular realization of the fractal geometry, which is in fact compatible using the engineering approximation with the active zone predicted by the Makarov theorem, which would be 27. Of course, this is not the topic of my talk. The topic, the first part of the talk, is dedicated to some analogy between Laplace and Stokes. This is also very important for engineering terms, in the sense that the loss of the charge that you have in pipes in industry is very important. So what would be the effect of something similar to Makarov theorem in terms of Stokes? So is there any compatibility between these two systems? In mathematical terms, I would say yes. It's just a conjecture. So here you have a typical Makarov set of diffusion process and the solution of that. And in comparison to that, what you would have in terms of a flow in a pipe would be the Stokes equation. I'm assuming that the inertial contribution to the flow are very low. Okay, so we have only the contribution to the flow of the viscous term here. And of course you have classical non-slip boundary conditions at the interface. I would possibly assume that the profile at very low Reynolds numbers is a typical Hagen-Poiseuille profile, considering that we have some sort of flatness, cross-grain flatness of this tube, and of course you would have a constant velocity at symmetry plane of the wrapped tube. So this is the solution for the Laplacian problem, and this is the solution for the Navier-Stokes problem. So I have flow from left to right here. I'm just showing you the flow inside of the cavity. This is Stokes. Yes, yes. This is the Stokes flow. So I'm not showing you the flow inside of the tube. Of course, when you induce flow in this way, momentum will be transported laterally from the inner part of the tube to the entrance of the cavity, of the fractal cavity. So at this point, you induce vortices in the large cavities of your system. And these vortices will have an intensity which is proportional to the cavity itself, and also somehow proportional to the to the proximity of the inner flow. Okay, so there are several theorems on that showing that these vortices in a simple conical structure would decrease in an exponential way. So this was proved by Moffat in the 60s. So this is the type of flow that we have. So what can we do now? Instead of computing the heat flow or the electrical analog flow in each elementary unit here, we compute at each elementary unit the shear stress along the interface. So this would be the analogous to the heat flow in the Laplacian problem. So we compute that, and we can plot this for each unit of the irregular interface. Okay, so this is the normalized flux for both systems. Here you have the Stokes flux along the elementary units of the interface, and here you have the Laplace one. So qualitatively, they look very, very similar. So this is a very, of course, this has been studied by Everson and Mandelbrot in 1992, and of course it has a very highly heterogeneous property. And we can see now that if you put this against this, if we put the Stokes flux against the Laplacian flux, in fact, what we see is that there is a relationship which is very close to linear between these two measures. So somehow, there is some analogy between these two systems. So it's for the mathematicians to prove that this, this conjecture is correct or not, formally speaking. So we have published, we have just this paper accepted. So of course we can go, since we are doing it numerically, it's simple to increase the Reynolds number and see the effect of inertia in the system. In the simple case of a deterministic fractal like the square log curve that we are using here, what we see here, for low Reynolds number, the inertia appears here in the Navier-Stokes equation. What you see is simply that when you increase the Reynolds number, you somehow break the symmetry of the vortices inside of the cavity, inside of the fractal cavity. So how does this affect the global measure, some sort of macroscopic measure of your system? That's what we did next. In terms of two macroscopic variables, the first one is the active zone itself, as we defined it previously, and the second one is the permeability, as we defined in terms of this very handsome and charming, I don't know why, because maybe he has a very big nose and he's bold. Huh? it was Darcy who proposed an analogy between flow, hydraulic flow and electrical flow in resistors and channels. So he simply said that in analogy with electrical flow, you have the difference of the pressure difference between the entrance and the exit of a tube should be proportional in the regime of Stokes to the velocity or the flux crossing the system. So what we have here for the permeability in different generations of the square core curve is that there is some difference at low Reynolds number, but not as dramatic as one could think. So somehow we can say that there is some analogy between the Laplacian system and the Stokes flow system here. But as you increase the Reynolds number, the difference between the generations become more dramatic, I would say, and the effect of inertia becomes relevant at high Reynolds conditions.
Can I ask a question about the previous? So you're treating the full Navier-Stokes equation?
In this particular case, yes.
And you get steady flows or not?
I get steady flows, yes.
You get steady flows?
Yes.
No intermittent behavior?
Not at this range of Reynolds number.
So high.
Yes, you'll have to increase a lot the Reynolds number to get some sort of intermittency. We are still in the laminar region. Turbulence is still far away from this.
But...
You don't believe it.
I mean, it's a lot of boundary, right?
A lot of boundary. Oh, yes.
I mean, to make a turbulent boundary layer, you do something like that. I mean, sometimes you want a turbulent boundary layer.
Oh, yes.
And you do something like that. You make the surface very rough. And then it does create a turbulent layer at low Reynolds number. And that's a pretty rough looking surface. So.
Yes, what we call turbulence is, we can discuss it later. But the point here is that I am imposing the fact that the flow is still laminar.
You're imposing it?
No, I'm imposing the Reynolds number and the velocity inside of the sphere. So I can check whether the fluctuations are higher locally than in a simulation where turbulence is in fact taking place.
So your Reynolds number is not much bigger than, or maybe no bigger than one.
No, for the previous case, not. In the case that I compare the Laplacian and the
right.
Stokes flow, not. But here, a little bit, it can go up to 1,000. But
yeah,
I still couldn't see. This has been tested at least in our code. I still couldn't see any sort of intermittent behavior.
Even near the boundaries, I mean, you know.
Yeah, but from a numerical point of view, you have to increase the mesh. Of course, you can always find some sort of fluctuations near the boundary. Okay. Anyway, so we also did some simulations for the random problem. Yes.
Is the previous slide the one we just? What was the parameter again? Just two slides before? No, before one. Before.
Okay, sorry.
No, again, sorry.
yeah.
Oh, so just flux.
These are fluxes. Okay.
But you had very, very slow motions, right?
At that case, yes.
Yeah.
So that I could compare Stokes and Laplace. Okay, so we go further a little bit. I'm not going into the details of that, but we also did simulations for a random fractal wall. And what we found was that the active zone doesn't change very much from one subset of the wall to another. So these fluctuations are really acceptable in terms of the active zone of the system. Okay, so we skip to the second part of the talk, which is related with heat transport. So instead of having only flow, I now combine flow and heat inside of the same system. So the set of the system that I'm trying to simulate here is heat transport between two self-similar rough walls. So I am still keeping the same geometry of a square or curve. So I'm assuming that I have constant properties of viscosity, density, and diffusive conductivity. So I'm assuming also steady state. So the temperature doesn't change. Luckily, it changed in the space, but not in time anymore. And for that, I have to solve the diffusion convection equation inside the tube once I have the flow established. So I'm also assuming that the flow is at steady state, although you don't like it, but it's there. So we freeze the flow. We assume that there is no coupling between the heat transport and flow, and we solve that. So I'm assuming that the temperature at the wall interface is constant, so Dirichlet boundary conditions at the boundaries. The flow penetrates in the system at a constant temperature too, and what we have to solve is coupled to a given flow velocity field, I have to solve the scalar field of temperature inside of the system. And so this is the type of temperature profiles that I get. So the relevant parameter here is the Peclet number. The Peclet number is a measure of the time for diffusion to be to be important in terms of convection. So if the Peclet number is very high, convection is the dominant mechanism in my system. If the Peclet number is very low, diffusion is the dominant mechanism in my system. So the time for diffusion is very, very large. So that's what you have for a very low Peclet number. So the system behaves essentially as a diffusion cell. So the convection doesn't affect the transport of heat from one side to another of the tube. So as you increase the Peclet number, the convection starts to become relevant in the system. So as you go from red to blue, you're going from a high temperature to a low temperature. But you have to increase a lot the Peclet number to see some effects on the wall protrusions
So you're changing this Petworth number by changing the diffusion constant.
I can do that by changing the diffusion constant or the convection itself. If I change the convection, I have the radius to
right.
be careful.
I was going to say. So.
Okay. So the temperatures, as I said, go to blue to from blue to red. So it's important to quantify what's going on here in terms of some sort of heat flux and active zone length. So the first thing I'm going to show you is the heat flux. So as you can see here, are the simulations for the flux at the interface. When you compare the solution for the smooth tube, which by the way is called the Graetz problem in the traditional literature of numerical heat transport. So this is the solution. As you increase the Packlet number, the heat flux grows in this way for the smooth tube. So this is a very in log-log. This is a very close to a linear profile, and the exponent here is 1/3. It can be proved analytically for the Graetz problem. The flux goes with the Packlet number to a power law in terms of a power law with exponent 1/3. And what you see here for low Packlet numbers, where diffusion dominates, you see that there is a almost perfect collapse between the smooth tube and the fractal tube. Why is that? Because you have Makarov cells along the interface. So the Makarov cell makes that the system, the transport of heat, is not possible to be distinguished between the geometrical details of different interfaces. So this is dramatic again for the design of heat transfers. If you want to increase the surface area of your heat exchanger, you are not supposed to do it at low Packlet numbers. Mm-hmm. That's the message for engineers. So in other terms, when you increase the Packlet number, these regions here, where you already know that there are vortices, they are not stagnated, these regions here can transport heat through convection. And then you see distinctions between the smooth and the fractal tubes. You can easily distinguish. Of course, in another level of distinction, you would have to go to a different generation, to a different level of the fractal interface itself, to see a different distinction between different generations of the fractal geometry. Okay. Of course, you can also quantify the effect in terms of a more sensitive measure, which is the active zone of the entire geometry. As you can see here, rough and smooth show practically the same behavior at low Packlet numbers. But as you increase the Packlet number, the vortices will have some effect on the transport of heat, and the roughness effect is much more determinant on the transport of the activity in the fractal geometry. Okay, so these are some propaganda that I have to make. We have been providing a lot of citations for Professor Makarov along the time. And I would like to skip to the last part of my talk. I promised I would be very quick, so. I decided to talk about that instead of talking about the transport of particles, because I saw a lot of people showing percolation results here. So the motivation here is very similar to what Professor Kane showed at the beginning of this conference. He's a professor and he's very young to be.
He's a professor.
Yes, okay.
So.
So the motivation, of course, involves money, and money is in nanotechnology these days. So we have to be a little bit mercenary, you know. So of course, the idea is that we do some material design. And why is that? I would like to talk a little bit about Dan Dreamers, as he also said, he also talked a little bit, Professor Kenyon, in the sense that the Dan Dreamers are especially suitable to functional polymers, in the sense that they have a very large functionality area, so that you can couple functional radicals to the surface of those Dan Dreamers in order to do drug delivery, in order to improve the supports of the catalyst, and also to design better structures, supramolecular structures. So the dendrimers are dead, you know? So they're, in fact, branching molecules. So they're functional because you can always add to each tip of the dendrimer some sort of important radical for a chemical reaction or something else. And what people see in many simulations is always that these molecules, which are ordered molecules, have a fractal dimension close to 2.5. Do they really exist yes, people have been there. They are real molecules, so they can be synthesized in labs, so the chemists can do it very well in a very controlled way. So I'm just showing you here a scheme for the generation of a typical dendrimer. So what do we propose here? We propose a diff. So this is a, these are real realizations of dendrimers proposed by Tao and Hat in 2005. So what we propose here, as I said, those dendrimers were deterministic ones. Is it possible to induce some sort of disorder in their geometries? Okay, so we are trying to do that, and the idea is that we induce this disorder in terms of percolation. So the generation is typical percolation type of algorithm. So what do? You simply start from a square or honeycomb lattice of size L. So you extract the spanning cluster, of course. We do that exactly at the critical point, so that we have an infinite cluster, although there are a lot of controversies with the existence of that in this conference. You know? And so what we do is simply say that, simply assign to each site of this remaining spanning cluster. So I forgot to say that we do site percolation. So the remaining sites, we assign carbon atoms to them, and then we assume that they're connected by single bonds, single chemical bonds. So once you do that, you have to adjust the valence of your system to 4, of course, because you are dealing with carbons, and you do that by adding the necessary number of hydrogen atoms. So once you do that, you generate a fractional stoichiometry, in the sense that this x and y numbers here are not integers.
So I'm sorry, so you're doing this on the spanning cluster, or you do this in the complement of the spanning cluster?
No, I'm doing it on the spanning
cluster. On the spanning cluster.
Exactly. So I extract the spanning cluster and assign to each site a carbon atom, and then I complement them with hydrogens. So of course, this will be very easy to do, but now we have some sort of additional step, which is to find that you really have some sort of optimized geometry in terms in energetical terms. So to do that, we used, I'm not an expert on that, so I have to join with the...
Sir, can I ask a question?
Of course, yes.
What do you do if two sites both neighbor on the same vacancy? You put the hydrogen atom there and then you claim that they share it?
No. In the spanning cluster, each site is a carbon.
Yes.
So if you use a square lattice...
Yes.
And the maximum connection you can have is 4, which is okay for the carbon.
Yes.
So whenever you extract one of them, the remaining connections which needed to complement the valence to 4 are made with hydrogens.
What if two carbons impinge on the same site where you can only put one hydrogen atom?
I don't understand the question. You will see it in the next slide.
Okay.
So. So in order to solve in order to optimize the geometry, we use here force fields from classical mechanics. This is called molecular mechanics. So you simply assign potential energy in terms of analytical functions. So the potential energy can be described in terms of many different movements of the molecules. For instance, the movement of the bond itself, it's like that. Yes. And the movement the angle is like that, and doesn't stop, huh? So these are just two examples of the potential energies that you compute in the optimization process. So for that, there are standard bases that you use. These potential expressions here are not totally classical. There are some components of quantum ingredients on that. So for that, I'm using, these are very specified names. It's MM plus force field to generate the optimized geometry. This is purely classical mechanics, but we have compared that with semi-empirical, self-consistent quantum potentials. For instance, we used PM3 here, and we found that there is only 3% of difference in terms of the variables that we are interested in, which is in this case is the gyration radius of the final molecule.
Just
yes.
For the notation, the potential for bonding slash angle, is that
this one?
That's the what does that mean? Slash that's division or something?
The
yes, that's the one.
So this is the coupling. You can allow for coupling between bound and angle in your system. So this is, maybe this will answer your final question. Then you start from a square lattice, you remove all the sites according to a critical percolation probability. You add hydrogens to those which are not complemented in terms of valence 4. Okay, and then you start your optimization geometry process. So maybe I wasn't very clear.
And is this in and the original cluster is in two dimensions?
Yes,
and,
yes,
and
yes.
The optimization occurs also in two dimensions?
The optimization is in three.
In three dimensions.
Yes, sorry, I didn't make myself clear. You are right. Yes.
Sorry.
So while it's optimizing, we can talk about the next World Cup. And Brazil is going to humiliate France, no? I hope. So it takes some time.
Don't dream.
So once the optimization process, I don't know, it's very slow here, takes place, of course, you have to do that for several realizations of the system. You cannot go to very large system sizes. So this is the typical realization of the problem. So of course, I didn't show all the steps in the optimization process. So as I said, once you do that, for a typical system size, you have to do it for several realizations of the disorder. And in order to see some sort of finite size scaling properties, you have to do it for different system sizes too. So that's what we did. And also we did it for different types of geometries, embedding geometries. So when you do that for carbon, when you do that for mantles, what you see as a result of the optimization process is that it bends in a corrugated type of lattice, which has a shape of a tile. By chance, this became a very fashionable topic in condensed matter physics. These are called graphenes, or somehow they have very, very special properties in terms of electrical conductance. In our case, as I said, we start from a two-dimensional lattice. You allow the system to optimize the geometry. We did this for square lattices, and we also did it for honeycomb lattices. So they had two different critical points to get this spanning cluster. So we did a set of different simulations. Of course, we worked with the critical square and honeycomb lattices, the system size that we use for that. As I said, we couldn't go for very large system sizes. It's a prohibited simulation. And what we are interested in here is the gyration radio, to see whether the system is fractal or not. You know? To give some, it's not to show that it's fractal or not, to give some measure of fractality, if it's so. So the gyration radius here is defined in this way, it's the standard way. It's a measure of the volume of your system. So what we found is that when you plot the gyration radio with the average molecular weight of those percolating polymers, percolating hydrocarbons, you see that for the square and the hexagonal embedding lattices, they have very similar behavior. The exponents are different, slightly different from 0.4 and 0.38. Of course, this means that the fractal dimension for the square type of simulation is close to 2.5, in accordance with the dendrimers, deterministic dendrimers that we have talked about at the beginning. And in the case of for the honeycomb, it's slightly different, 2.6. The difference is not so large when you think in terms of the system size that we are using, and by the fact that we are also, we also have these hydrogens giving a different degree of complexity to the problem. So there's another measure that we did just to confirm that our simulations were not so restrictive in terms of size, which can be simply the volume, which is called the van der Waals volume of the molecule, which is simply the volume of each molecule in your system. So in fact, we recover the fractal dimension of the spanning cluster for the square and the honeycomb, which is supposed to be 1.89. We recover here 1.85. And as I said, of course, this comes from finite size effects, the difference between this and the standard result, and as well as the presence of hydrogens in my system.
Yeah, there's more hydrogens in the honeycomb.
Yes, exactly, because the connectivity is lower by from the beginning.
Well, the surface area to volume ratio is the cluster size.
So is it possible? In fact, as I said to you, graphenes are a very fashionable topic, and these are typical photographs of the graphenes. This paper has been published in Carbon 2004. So the idea is now that, is it possible to remove some atoms, some carbon atoms in a disordered way? We proposed a technique which we called the self-organized percolation. This was back in 1985 when self-organized criticality was very fashionable too. So the idea is that in this particular type of percolation problem, the percolation probability changes with time according to the number of tips that you have at a given time. So the number of tips is here, and you always compare this number of tips with a fixed number of tips. So by doing that, you impose some sort of first order control to your system, and by chance, without knowing nothing about a priori about the critical point itself, you end up with some sort of the system evolves spontaneously to the critical point. And it's interesting to see that this rule here, we also propose a conceivable experimental way to do that using Gresham polymers. Anyway, so that's the end of my talk.